Good morning. Good morning. I do that every time. One of these days, you're going to get it on the first try. It's good to see you guys this morning. Something you should know about me, and I was trying to remember one of the difficult things about speaking, and I don't know how Bill does it, but speaking for several years, especially at a lot of different places and teaching in a lot of different places, I have a hard time already remembering if I've said something before or told a particular story before, and most of the time I just think, well, you guys just get to hear it again. So if you've heard any of what I'm about to say, just pretend this is the first time. But one thing that you should know about me is I have always known what I wanted to do with my life. It started when I was really little, and I wanted to be a cowboy. That was my main goal in life, was to be a cowboy. I even had an old pair of chaps and vests that my dad had when he was a kid, and I would wear that. And so sometimes when I have the handlebar mustache, this is just me living into my childhood dream. But I wanted to be the cowboy, and I made a cowboy hat out of a cardboard box, and I had a holster with a little cap gun in it, and I was going to be the guy that rode in and saved the day. And then someone showed me a rodeo and what a cowboy actually was, and I thought, yeah, that's a pass. I don't want any part of that. And so then I switched. The logical next step was then I decided I wanted to be a heart surgeon. I wanted to be a doctor. I mean, that's what one does, right? You go from thinking about being a cowboy to, of course, an adjacent profession of heart surgeon. And so I would even sign all of my homework, Dr. Hatfield. And it got to where the teachers and classmates would even call me Doc. And to this day, if you were to go to where my hometown and I ran into someone, they would say, hey, Doc, how's it going? And so that lasted for a good bit until probably seventh or eighth grade when we dissected a cow heart and thought, no. I don't think so. Probably not a good idea to pass out if you're in the operating room, someone's laughing your hand, and you're just, you know, you're gone. So it's like, okay, that's not for me. But I like the idea of a doctor. I like the idea of having that. So I thought maybe psychology, you know, understanding how the mind works and being able to help people. And that actually lasted quite a little bit until really freshman year of high school. So actually really only 2 years. And my freshman year, my parents got a video camera, and I discovered the joy of making videos. I would make, with my G.I. Joes in my room, stop-action animation, and with my friends, I would make movies. And that idea carried me all the way into college, and I wanted to go to film school, and I was actually accepted to a film school, and that was where I was headed, until some life circumstances intervened, probably my parents' prayers. And I switched from wanting to make movies to being a minister, wanting to be a minister. And I know when I made that choice, my parents were just, you know, they were celebrating. But they had supported me throughout all of these changes. Now, it seems strange to say that I always knew what I wanted to do with my life and then proceeded to tell you about all the ways in which I changed my mind, jumping from one thing to another. But if you think about it, the trajectory of my choices was always along a path about who I wanted to be. I just didn't quite know how I wanted to express myself. I always wanted to be someone who mattered. I wanted to be someone that was significant. I wanted to be able to leave a mark. I wanted to be able to help other people. It's interesting, if you talk to just about any age group, whether it's young kids all the way to grown adults, one thing that I think you'll find in common, if you ask questions like, what worries you? What keeps you up at night? What do you long for? I think underneath a lot of those answers, when you dig down to the root cause, the human condition that we all have in common is wanting to matter. Wanting to be significant, wanting to be someone. This morning, if you find yourself agreeing with that, being able to relate to the idea of wanting to be someone, wanting to be significant, wanting to know your value, then this is the lesson for you. I want us to think this morning about how to find meaning and significance in your life. How to answer this question, why you matter, why you make a difference, why you're important. And I want to suggest that the first step to knowing why you matter is to have a better understanding of knowing what matters. Because so much of the time, what matters to us helps shape or does shape how we feel about ourselves. And I want to suggest to you this morning that what matters most is hope. Hope is what matters most in our life. Now, hope tends to get a bad rap. Hope tends to conjure in our minds this idea of a naive chump pushing against a wall, hoping it's going to move, and it doesn't. But that's not what hope is. Hope, as defined by hope theory, is something more than that. It's beyond just an emotional kind of thing. Hope theory suggests that hope is one of the most important factors in a person's well-being, what we put our hope in. It's not just a feel-good thing, but hang with me here, it is a dynamic, cognitive, motivational system. In other words, hope grants a person the will and determination to get where they want to be. Hope is what keeps a person going when they might otherwise give up. Hope is the thing that we have that says, it can get better. I can be more. Maybe a story would help illustrate this. So, how many of you play golf? Do we have any golfers in the crowd? Maybe kind of, sort of, some of us. One of my absolute favorite stories to tell, and I already see Andy laughing over here. One of my favorite stories to tell is when I first started becoming associated with the McFarland family. And Carrie and I were dating, and things were getting serious, and we decided she's going to meet me, you know, bring me home and meet the family. And so I passed the first test by tasting all the weird plants that Kay wanted me to taste, even though, like, I hate anything green, unless it's green Skittles. But I passed that test, and the next test was the brothers. So Rob was home. He and Andy decided they were going to take me out to golf. And I was like, yeah, sure, I golf. I mean, I golf, but I don't, you know, golf. And they golf. And so I was excited. I showed up, and I've got my tennis shoes on, a t-shirt, and gym shorts. And in my mind, they showed up with like $100 golf shoes and fancy pants and like a Tiger Woods emblazoned shirt kind of thing. That's at least how I'm seeing it in my head when I think back on it. And we get up there, and I'm like getting nervous because these guys are like, they're serious about this, right? And so they both take their shots, and they were great. They were great shots, and they went where they were supposed to go, you know, as sometimes people who know what they're doing can make things happen, you know. And I'm getting really nervous, and at this point, I'm just like, you know, trying to make sure I'm not going to lose the golf club when I swing it. And so I get up there, and I line up as best I can, and I just take a monster swing at it. You know, I just really swing, and let me tell you, it was the most beautiful thing you've ever seen. It just went so far, like 900 yards at least. You know, at least that's what would have happened had I not hit the ground about 3 feet behind where the ball was. And it was like, you know, I just didn't loosen up enough, you know, and I got real nervous. And then finally, I made contact with the ball. And it was such a good feeling. And the best part was I only had to walk like 6 feet to take my next shot. And so the whole day went like that. But on my day off, I still go play golf. You know why? For those of you who have golfed, tell me why. Because that day I had the one shot. That one shot where it feels right, it sounds good, it goes where it's supposed to go. It was that one thing, that one shot that gave me hope that maybe I can be better. That gave me hope that this isn't as good as it's going to get. Unfortunately, that was as good as it's going to get. No, I've gotten better since then. But that's what hope does for us. We can hope that things will be better, that tomorrow will look different, that where we are right now isn't where we're going to be forever. The problem we run into is when we put our hope in the wrong things. Thankfully, for those of us who are Christians, we have a hope that endures, a hope that is beyond us. In 1 Peter chapter 1 and verse 3, we're going to spend our time here this morning. Peter lets us in on where our hope is and the nature of the Christian's hope. He says, "Blessed be the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, According to his great mercy, he has caused us to be born again to a living hope. Through the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead, to an inheritance that is imperishable, undefiled, unfading, kept in heaven for you. You, who by God's power are being guarded through faith for a salvation ready to be revealed in the last time. It is in this you rejoice, though now for a little while, if necessary, you are grieved by trials, so that the tested genuineness of your faith, which is more precious than gold, may be found to result in the praise and glory and honor at the revelation of Jesus Christ. What matters most is hope, but not just any hope. Hope that is given to us by God. That is why it is the greatest hope of all. It is a result of the love and the mercy of God that he has and shows towards his people to send his son to us. This isn't a family thing that we are born into physically. It is a family thing that we choose to be born into spiritually. It is a living hope. It is a thing that once we grab hold of and we unite with Christ in his baptism, it's now a living hope. And that's so important because when hope lives, as it's based in Jesus' resurrection from the dead, it means that the greatest enemy of all has been overcome, death. When our hopes can be marred and taken away by so many things in life, this is a hope that endures. This is a hope that is never put to shame. This is a living hope that gives us life. And in the face of difficulties, it's a hope that doesn't back down. Peter says it's also a hope that when we are in this new family, it comes with an inheritance. An inheritance that is legally ours as being family with God. Heirs of God's promise, this is an inheritance that he says nothing can destroy and nothing can take away. This living, indestructible hope, this inheritance that no power can take away, he says, is salvation. Salvation through the power of God, salvation being guarded and kept in heaven for us. And so this is an interesting point that Peter introduces us to. He entices us to think about this idea of a now, but a not yet. He wants us to think about this relationship between the present hope and the future hope in the Christian story. The future salvation, the fullness of what we can experience is yet to come. That's why we can say, as good as things might be or as bad as things might be now, it pales in comparison to what is in store for us. And so we await for that future with hope, hope that it can be more, that it will be more. Yet this salvation is also a present reality that we take hold of by faith in God and through the love of Christ. And so we are able to walk by faith and not by sight because we have this unquenchable hope that one day we will be with the one for whom we hope. And so this hope is embodied in the present in an active faith that trusts in God and knows that he will be with us. I've been reading a book called Amazing Grace by an author named Jonathan Kozel. He wrote this book in 1995 about the poor residents of the South Bronx in New York. And he spends time detailing their horrid living conditions. Rat-infested apartments, violence, drugs on the street, people fighting addictions, economic distress, just some of the most terrible living situations you can imagine here in the States. But while he introduces us to this community and all the terrible things that are happening, he also paints a picture of a life of community of faith that live in the South Bronx. And the people and the way they cling to God and the way they cling to hope. And as he talks to these residents, these people of faith, he begins to come to understand that they all share this sort of communal story of hope that rests in a single hymn, Amazing Grace. And everyone agrees the best verse of that song in this community is the one that captures the heart of what we're saying. Through many dangers, toils, and snares, I've already come. 'Tis grace that has brought me safe thus far, and grace will lead me home. When life is difficult, when we question and wonder, who am I? What is my value? What is my worth? When we struggle with how different we seem to be, hope is the thing that keeps us going. And so how does this hope direct us? How does this hope that we have in God, this living hope that is being kept for us, that is given to us right now, how does this help direct us? How does this give us a sense of self-worth or identity or significance? Well, psychology says there are two ways to find significance in your life. There are two ways that you can go about building self-esteem. And the first way, they say, is unstable. It is unstable self-esteem, or they call it contingent self-esteem. Now, how this looks is basically it says you pick a metric, and you just go out and you just try to own it. You play that game, you play it as hard as you can, and you just kill it. You just do it as well as you can, and that's your metric of success. That's how you determine significance. And so it's saying you just pick one, like a career. A career is how I'm going to identify myself. It's where I'm going to find my value or my worth. And so I go out and I try to get all the promotions that I can. And I try to get the raises and I try to get the best parking spot in the corner office. And I try to make all the money and get the best retirement plan. Or maybe they say it's health. You decide that that's going to be who I am. That's going to how I'm to determine who I am and my value. I'm going to pick the right diet and I'm going to exercise and I'm going to become a person of value by how I take care of my body. For some, they say it may be creativity, where I'm going to write the best song or I'm going to paint the best picture or take the best photograph or make the best movie. And that is where I'm going to find who I am. And for others, and it gets a little closer to home, they say, family. I'm going to have the perfect family. We're going to have 2.5 kids and a dog. No cats, because cats are terrible. But we're going to have the 5-bedroom house, and we're going to have 2 cars, and we're going to take so many vacations every year, and we're going to have the pictures on the wall, on the beach or in the mountains, and we're all going to be dressed alike, even though our kids think that's a terrible idea. And it's going to be great. And we're going to hang all of our value and our worth and our identity on this thing. But the problem with that is, and the reason they say it's unstable, is because it's like taking a peg, sticking it in a sheetrock wall, and saying, I'm going to hang all of my hopes, all of my dreams, all of my self-worth and value on this one thing. And then heaven forbid something happens, and I lose my job, or my family falls apart, or I get sick. And suddenly, everything we've built our life on, everything we've hung our hopes and our dreams on, comes crashing down, and we're left wondering, well, who am I now? The other thing that psychologists say where we can find our significance or value is in a stable self-esteem or a unconditional self-esteem. This is the exact opposite. This is where we put our peg in the wall and we hang on it, something that cannot be shaken, something that cannot be taken away from us, something that no matter what comes at it, what is thrown at it, however much our lives shake, it stays put. It is immovable. Now, psychology isn't really able to offer exactly what that looks like. They just say that's the most reliable predictor of happiness, is to base your value, your meaning, your significance, something that can't be taken away from you. But we don't really know what that is. Thankfully, as we've been discussing this morning, we know exactly what that is. We know exactly the peg in the wall. We know exactly what to hang on that. Narrowly defined, it's what Peter has been talking about and what he talks about in his whole letter, this contrasting two ways of living. Only Peter's language sounds like the perishable versus the imperishable. I want you to look at verse 13 in chapter 1. He turns to this very idea, a direction that we point ourselves towards. Therefore, preparing your minds for action, being sober-minded, set your hope fully on the grace that will be brought to you at the revelation of Jesus Christ. As obedient children, do not be conformed to the passions of your former ignorance, but as he who has called you is holy, you also be holy in all your conduct, since it is written, you shall be holy, for I am holy. And if you call on him as Father, the one who judges impartially according to your deeds, conduct yourselves with fear throughout your time of exile, knowing that you were ransomed from the futile ways inherited by your forefathers, not with perishable things like silver or gold, but with the precious blood of Christ. Verse 22, he says, having purified your souls by your obedience to the truth for a sincere brotherly love, love one another earnestly from a pure heart. Broadly speaking, Paul is talking about the difference between holiness and what he calls your futile ways or the passions of your former ignorance. This is exactly what we're talking about. He mentions something that we can kind of get our minds around when he says it's perishable, like silver and gold. And so we say, yeah, that's money. That's possessions. And we all get that can be fleeting. It can go away. But then he says, also, your futile ways or the passions of your former ignorance. Those are also things to turn away. And if we know anything about the readers, we know he's talking about paganism, the worship of other gods. Now, we may initially go, whew, thank goodness. You know, when's the last time any of us had a struggle with, you know, burning some incense to an idol in our house? But if we stop and consider, we're talking about worship. And worship is simply what I direct myself towards. What I spend the most of my time thinking about, working towards, actively seeking, placing all of my hope. And that certainly can be things like career and status and popularity and what my friends think of me and this, that, or the other. All of those things are perishable. They can easily be knocked off the wall. Instead, what he says is turn your attention to holiness. And holiness, as Peter defines it, is simply being set apart like God. He says, be holy as God is holy. And if holiness is being set apart for a purpose, and we are to be holy as God is holy, it means that we are to live our lives in such a way that tries to seek out and achieve the purposes of God. We devote ourselves to God's will. We devote ourselves to the things of God. And as he says in verse 22, this is loving earnestly from a pure heart. Peter encourages us to turn away from the things that we seek value from, significance from, and instead find those things in God's will. Find those things in a life intent on living according to God's purpose. So answering this question of why you matter is first about understanding what matters. And it's a difficult, moving target when we try to define our meaning, our significance in the things of the world, using culturally appropriate terms like power or politics or success or money or popularity or any of those kinds of things that the world says, this is how you define yourself. This is how you find your identity. Instead, Peter says, those things are temporary and they constantly change. Instead, turn your mind, build your foundation on the hope of God, living a life according to his purposes. So what matters is that our foundation of hope, the thing that drives us, is God-given. It's unchanging. It's protected for us. What matters is directing ourselves not towards the perishable, but the imperishable. In his book on the Bronx, Jonathan Causal contrasts two citizens of New York. One is a newspaper columnist who has given up on the invisible realities and divinely driven hope. And this is what she writes. Out there, someone is sleeping on a grate. The emergency rooms are full of people. Cruelty is as natural to the city as fresh air is to the country. And she says, I used to feel this cruelty was wrong and immoral, but now I don't know. Maybe it is the fuel that powers the palace. So while this woman rejoices in the cruelty-fueled palace, there's a boy that Jonathan writes about whose name is Anthony. He grows up in South Bronx without a fraction of her security or worldly wealth. Yet in a report, he writes about his hope for the kingdom of God. And this is what he says.
God will be there. He'll be happy that we've arrived. People will come hand in hand. It will be bright, not gloomy like on earth. As for television, forget it. If you want a vision, you can use your eyes to see the people you love. No one will look at you from the outside. They will only see you on the inside. All the people from the street will be there. My uncle will be there and he'll be healed. No violence will be in heaven. There'll be no guns, drugs, IRS. You won't have to pay taxes. All of the children who died when they were little will be there, and Jesus will be good to them, and he will play with them. At night, he'll come to visit you in your house, and God will be fond of you. And this is how he finishes his little essay. He says, "How will you know if you're there? Something in you will say, 'This is it.'" And then he asks, or then he says, "But if you still feel lonely in your heart or bitter, you'll know you're not there." So in answering the question this morning of why you matter, please do not be mistaken, confused, or fooled into using or choosing the wrong metric. The futile ways of the world are going to chew you up and spit us out, leaving us lonely and bitter. Instead, Peter encourages us to set our minds and our hearts on the hope and holiness that God offers us. And in those things, let's find our meaning. This morning, we want to offer you the invitation to accept this great gift that you have been given, to accept the living hope that can be yours through partnering with Christ in his death and baptism. Maybe you need the prayers of the church to help you regain that hope, to come back, to give up all the things that you want to find meaning in. Instead, let us as a community help you find your meaning in the things that truly matter in this world. If there's anything we can do for you this morning, please come while we stand and sing.